Kevin Baker, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation.
Thanks for having me, Ron.
Well, congratulations on your new book, The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. It's a very it's an exciting book. It's a fun book. It's a depressing book. You can tell how many questions I have by, I don't know if you can really see it, but I earmarked like every other page.
Great. Glad to hear it. Happy to
And
answer them all.
wrote in the wrote in the I'm a believer in writing in the margins,
Sure.
pointing things out. So first of all, writing about New York seems to be I won't call it a hobby for you. This is a business, but
Yeah.
between nonfiction and fiction books, you write a lot about New York. Why is that?
It really has become my vocation. I've lived here for almost half a century, for 48 years, pretty much my entire adult life. My parents were both born here. My father was born on Fordham Road, my mother in Washington Heights. But really, it's a fascinating place in and of itself, beyond our connections to it. New York, to me, is the real heartland in America. It's where, more than anywhere else, people have come from all over the world and have argued and fought and got together to decide what it really means to be an American and who is going to be an American. And sometimes there have been some pretty awful fights in the street, like the Civil War draft riots. To this day, the worst riots in our history. Sometimes they've been surprising, like the Stonewall uprising, where gay and lesbians in New York wouldn't take sort of the police harassment anymore. But there have also been great ways in which people came together peaceably to make this great country and this great city. And sometimes that even has included baseball, has even included the way we play our games.
One of the things I've noticed about New Yorkers, I am not a native New Yorker, although I did like you, I spent most of my life there, is there seems to be an aura of, I don't want to say superiority or entitlement,
You can say it. You can say
but you
it.
expect they expect a lot of people expect that New York is the end all and be all of, if not the world, certainly the United States. And they feel everything has to be bigger and better and faster and more glamorous. One of the things that this reminded me of reading the earlier chapters is the Gangs of New York.
Yes, yeah,
You weren't
which
by any
part of
chance
it.
involved in that, were you?
No, I was not involved in the Gangs of New York, although I did write a novel called Paradise Alley that was a lot about the draft riots and the Irish immigrant experience. About half my ancestors were Irish. Yeah, that was an interesting thing. It's yeah, we I can see how we're completely obnoxious to the rest of America. You know, in the last Subway World Series in 2000, the first one between the Yankees and Mets ever, was something like the lowest rated World Series of all time
Wow.
until I think the Tampa Bay Phillies series in 08, and you know, its ratings have declined since then. But you know, the rest of America wasn't interested in hearing us talk about how great we are. And it's hard to blame them. We're pretty obnoxious. The big, you know, but you can really divide the city. There's the big city that you were talking about, the city that claims to be the capital of world finance and fashion and everything else, that can pretty much, you know, get up your nose. But there's also what I like to refer to as the little city, the New York of about 10,000 neighborhoods, which is made up of people just working hard every day, trying to make a life for themselves, trying to make a better life for their children, and really living together in remarkable harmony, considering how much putting people from all over the world together has worked out in so many other places. It's a great thing in that sense.
Well, one of the things that makes me think of what you just said is that in your book, these people, the backbone of New York, are really the underdogs here. A lot of this book is about political corruption, racism, elitism. Yeah, baseball itself, at the very beginning, was a game basically for men, always for men,
Yes,
who
yeah.
had the means, who were gentlemen. It was a gentleman's game. These people had the time and the resources to be able to play the game. Obviously, this was before night baseball, so it had to be played during the daytime. And who's got time for that? Except these few people. And then baseball gradually turned as winning became important, and they started hiring out people who might not fit into their society, shall we say. And one thing led to another, and until we had professional leagues and all that that entailed. What kind of research is involved in doing this? Now, you've been writing for a long time,
Yeah.
and research has changed a lot. I would imagine it's become a lot easier to find material with the digitization of old newspapers. And talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's research has become somewhat easier with the internet. Of course, you're not always sure what you're getting on the internet is true. I was looking up Wally Pipp in Wikipedia, and there was some passage on it saying that his name originally was Wally was something Walter Pipik. And Pipik is Yiddish for belly button.
Right.
Yeah. And I thought, wait a minute. And sure enough, this was false, so you have to be careful of it in that sense, but it does help. I did most of the research for this from books, and I have a long bibliographical essay on the back. I really stood on the shoulders of giants. There's been a lot of great writing about both baseball and New York, and I was able to utilize that. Did do some in the newspapers, both the Times archive, but also going to the library to do everything from the Amsterdam News back in the 30s and 40s, which is a tremendous source for a lot about Black life in New York. There's a lot of great places you can go. But yeah, I think you're right. The New York game really mostly was played at first by white collar people, often bank clerks, in lots in New York and all. They were the people who had the most leisure time in the afternoon. But very quickly, it became a working man sport too. There was an early club called the Magnolia, which was made out of day laborers. And pretty soon, every profession had their baseball teams. There were teams made up of eye doctors, teams of milkmen, teams of cops and firemen. Almost everybody could come together and have this sort of democratic experience on the ball field and in the stands, where they could play and contend and sometimes brawl and make up and drink beer together. I say almost because that's one of the enduring tragedies of America, which was right from the beginning. They really tried to exclude people of color from this. Black people were really not wanted. There were still, nonetheless, 55 known African Americans playing professional baseball before 1884. And that's when the major leagues kind of really throw down the color wall, and there's nobody else known to be black and playing ball and organized ball until Jackie Robinson is signed. But that's really a terrible tragedy, a terrible thing for African Americans, terrible thing for us, who in the greater society, whites of all ethnicities, who didn't get to see these guys play. It was horrible. It's also, though, something of an inspiring story, like so much else in American culture, how Blacks and Hispanics made their own baseball culture despite these huge barriers in their way, and contributed hugely to the game, really made it a better sport.
Now, your book is divided into basically time frames, eras. You have the very early game, then you have the inside game from 1900 to
19, yeah.
19, and then when Babe Ruth comes, that's a whole other kettle of fish. And then the Depression, the war, was any one of these harder to deal with than another era? Like, what were
Well, I
the
mean,
88 years harder because it was more difficult to find material for that?
yeah, the earlier games, there's less material and there's kind of more mythology you have to weed through about it, starting with the great mythology of who invented the game, in which Major League Baseball, desperate to have the game not start in the city, came up with Abner Doubleday inventing the game along the shores of the Glimmerglass by
Now,
Cooperstown, New York.
excuse me, when you say baseball wanted a more romantic origin story, who are you referring to when you say baseball?
Yeah, it was really an effort by A.G. Spaulding, who was a player and an owner, and who we now know as the sporting goods magnate. He put together a commission around, I think, 1905, headed by A.G. Mills, the former president of the National League. And they were going to look into this. Spaulding desperately did not want the game to have English origins. Now, in reality, people have been playing some kind of bat and ball game since we first swung down from the trees. Everybody from Prague to Pittsfield, Mass, claims to be the city that started it. But what became the game we know as baseball today really started. It was the New York game. It was the Knickerbocker Rule started right here. That was not something that Spalding or the people he hired wanted to hear. They wanted it to be an American game, to have American origins. They desperately didn't want it to be found to be coming from Rounders or any other English bat and ball game. So, but they, hit upon this letter somebody sent, this complete crank sent in, saying that he was there when Doubleday started the game in, I think, 1839 along the banks of the Glimmerglass. And this is a total myth. Abner Doubleday was sort of the Forrest Gump of the 19th century. He was on hand when anything and everything happened. The first shot of the Civil War nearly hit him at Fort Sumter. He helped hold the line at Gettysburg. He commanded a regiment of black troops. He w went to Gettys back to Gettysburg with Lincoln for the Gettysburg Address. He went to seances at the White House with Mrs. Lincoln. He read Sanskrit. He corresponded with Ralph Waldo Emerson. He had the first cable car franchise in San Francisco, but he did not invent baseball. And they didn't really even think he did. A.G. Mills, the head of that commission, had been his best friend for 20 years, gave the eulogy at his funeral, and even he admitted that Doubleday never brought up baseball, never mentioned it. You'd think you'd say, you know that thing you're that president of? I invented that. Never came up. So this was always, it's to the point where the guy who's not in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown is Abner Doubleday. Not even they can quite believe it. So that they really wanted to put it in this great little village. And Cooperstown is a lovely, lovely town. Love the museum, been there twice. God bless. But that's not where the game started. It started in the big, grimy, as you mentioned, corrupt city, which was New York.
The New York game is obviously about the New York teams being the Giants, the Dodgers, and the Yankees. Can you, I don't know, speculate's the right word, what kind of demographic went toward each fan base?
It varied as the years went by, as it does now with the Yankees and Mets. But of course, Brooklyn, which was its own city, something like the fourth largest city in the US until it all merged in 1898, local people rooted for the Dodgers. The most popular team in the city until Babe Ruth got here were the New York Giants. They were up in Harlem. They were very much the Irish team. Both my father and my favorite uncle were big New York Giants fans until they moved out. This was very common. Irish people. My father was born in the Bronx, but this is very common for Irish New Yorkers. the Yankees, by moving to Yankee Stadium, they had fans all over New York and plenty of Manhattan, but they took advantage of what was then the big up-and-coming borough. The Bronx was the borough people really aspired to. Excuse me, you made some money for the first time in your lives. You've been working forever down in the Lower East Side. You moved up to the Bronx. This was the great middle-class borough. All kinds of people going up there, Jewish people, Italians, Irish, everybody. And they rooted for the Yankees. The Yankees had this huge new stadium. They were a very corporatized team very early on. They seemed to be the future. And they were dominant. They were very well run, and this brought in the fans. But it's interesting. Everybody was looking to get different great ethnic ball players in there. When the Yanks first signed Lou Gehrig, they go to Miller Huggins, the manager, and say they've signed him, and he says, "Is he Jewish?" And he wanted them to be Jewish. He was German, so the New York Giants signed a guy named Mo Solomon, who they called the papers dubbed the Rabbi of SWAT briefly. They wanted great Jewish players. The Yankees were very glad to get Tony Lazzari and then Joe DiMaggio, these great ethnic Italian, first big Italian stars in the city. They're really looking out to kind of fit in with the demographic that the city was becoming. That's how you got the fans out.
And of course, the Dodgers, once they signed Robinson, they had Poles, they had Jews, they had Italians, they had everybody. So I think that they were the people's team, it seems.
Very much. And it became America's team because of their whole radio network. And Robinson's signing was hugely, of course, hugely inspiring to African Americans, but it was sort of inspiring to everybody in Brooklyn. All of these different ethnicities, Jews, Catholics, everybody who had not until fairly recently been considered full Americans. Here was this symbol that, boy, okay, finally anybody could be in the club or on the club. And this was the thing that really made the Dodgers a special team for many New Yorkers in Brooklyn and out, and why it was all the more horrible when they took off just for money in the late 50s.
One of the things that I always think about is baseball during the Depression era and how, I mean, I know a lot of teams were seriously hurting for attendance. Was it the Browns who couldn't even get 90,000 for a single season? I mean, the fact that they were able to stay in business at all is amazing.
And that was sort of the a lot of these teams were barely hanging on to the Depression. The Browns considered moving to Los Angeles, which I dearly wish they had, because maybe we'd have the Dodgers in Brooklyn still. They didn't, because it was just too difficult without jet travel, which hadn't been developed yet. But baseball owners were amazingly recalcitrant to do about doing some common sense things. For instance, it took them a long time to put in lights. Most of the Negro League teams had lights before the major leagues did in the late 30s. And this is a time if you were desperate to have a job and you weren't going to give it up to go in the afternoon to the ball game, night baseball brought in all kinds of fans, but it took such a long time for them to realize this. The other thing was they didn't really understand radio, particularly in New York, and they would only have occasional broadcasts. A lot of the teams were very chary about this. They felt if they put games on the radio, people wouldn't come out and see the game. They didn't get that radio and then television were great advertisements for the game. All the more people are going to come out. It isn't until the rather crazy Larry McPhail comes and becomes sort of takes over the Dodgers that the teams in New York start to put the games on the radio, and then they quickly see how good this is for business, and everything changes.
One of the things you mentioned before is your bibliographical essay at the end. And I notice that in a
Yeah.
book that is so chock full of facts and quotes, you do not have notes. What was the decision behind that?
It seemed absurd to me to have a book about baseball chock full of footnotes. And
I mean, as it is,
it
this
just
book
seemed
is over 500
to
pages with the index. So I can only
yeah.
imagine how
Yeah,
I know a
exactly.
couple of hundred more for notes.
Yeah, I didn't feel it deserved, I wanted this to be kind of a really a popular history. I'm writing history now about the US between the world wars, but and I have notes in that, but they're going to be a lot of pages of notes. So I'm just as glad I don't have it for this. And there is a sequel too in this book goes from 1945, and the sequel will start then and go up to the present day. So that'll be out in the spring of 2026, but that doesn't have notes either. And you can, your wrists will feel all the better for it.
And I have that in my notes. One of the questions I was going to say is, it seems to end suddenly at the end of World War II. And one of the things I thought about, and I've never seen before, is a book about what was the, let me see, what did I write here? What was the mental health of Dodger and Giants fans when they left town? There was that void,
Yeah.
certainly between the 57 and when the Mets joined the
Yeah.
league. And I know that certainly Dodger fans and Giant fans are not going to become, for the most part, Yankee fans.
Right.
And some of them gave up on baseball altogether, as some
Yeah.
people did during the strike of 94. But I'm looking forward to that, and looking forward to having you back when that book comes out.
And it's already, I mean, this is the thing. I wrote this hugely long manuscript. The people at Knopf were very nice. They decided finally to chop it in half, which was a good decision. But in the second half, I get into all the reasons behind, and it's become kind of a debate again about the past, who was really to blame for those teams leaving. And there's sort of a popular movement to blame Robert Moses for it. And while I think Moses was in many ways a very destructive character, it's Walter O'Malley's fault that he took the team out, and it was purely out of greed. And I get into that. But one of the things O'Malley wanted to do was use he wanted the team to, first of all, just to basically condemn all sorts of businesses about where the Barclays Arena is now in Brooklyn, and give that land over to the city, which just doesn't wasn't done. In the late 1950s, cities didn't just hand over land or give big subsidies to ball teams. And Robert Moses said no, and he wanted them to build what became Shea Stadium out in Queens, and he was going to rent it to both the Giants and Dodgers for a very reasonable fee. Walter O'Malley didn't want this, and he said, "Well, I'll build the ballpark all my own." And Moses pointed out, "Well, your estimates are completely wrong. It'll cost you twice that much to build that park." Walter O'Malley said, "Well, let's use Title I, the slum clearance program after the war, the prime example of good intentions going bad in post-war America. It's supposed to be slum clearance, clear out these inner city." He said it cleared out a lot of housing and built a lot of bad housing projects. He said, let's use that. We can get some money for entertainment if we clear enough blocks." This would have meant tearing down 100 blocks of downtown Brooklyn, including a lot of beloved brownstone Brooklyn, to build him this big domed stadium he wanted. It's in some ways the best thing that ever happened to Brooklyn, and that if that was the alternative, was the Dodgers leaving. It was like avoiding a nuclear bomb, basically,
Wow.
in the middle of this of the borough. So, but it's interesting. I get into all the fights and disputes over that, but it was a terrible thing that they left. They and the Giants, who were about to produce these terrific teams with a lot of Black and Hispanic stars, they left East Harlem in good part because they felt it was too Black. They wanted to move to Minneapolis at first, instead moved to San Francisco, where Horace Stoneham ended up going bankrupt, the owner. And it's really a shame. It was part of a general feeling that New York was finished, that the big Eastern cities, older Midwestern cities were done. You should move out of them. You should move to so-called cleaner, newer, always whiter cities. And a lot of teams did that. And in retrospect, it was crazy. Yeah, the Athletics moving from Philadelphia, ending up in Oakland, and now they're going to go to Sacramento, and then they're like a road show now. These were disastrous decisions for the most part. The Giants going to Minneapolis would have been a terrible decision too, but that's how people were thinking at that moment.
How much did the politics of the Tammany Hall era in the 20s, how much did that play into baseball?
Yeah, and that's one of the themes in this book, which I get into. Tammany Hall, as the most enormous and most corrupt of all the political machines in the country, took a bite of everything. You didn't survive here as an entertainment unless you played ball with the political machine, with Tammany Hall. And at least two occasions, when a team was not playing ball, Tammany had a street driven through their stadiums, and they had to move on. This meant that the people who ran these ball teams had to be very closely connected to the machine, which they were. That also meant, though, that they were generally connected to organized crime, which Tammany Hall also had a big say in. And that was sort of inviting in the devil. It was inviting in gambling, which eventually almost ruined the sport. And to be sure, gambling apart from Tammany Hall was something Americans loved to do in the 19th century. American men bet on everything. It was very natural that they would start betting on baseball. But this got to the point, combined with the reserve clause, combined with attempts to keep salaries down, where fixing games became a regular thing. Started with games didn't mean much at the end of a season, ended up with the fixing of the 1919 World Series. And the fix itself actually took part, it took place in New York too, which I outline in this book. And this was almost disastrous. Only Babe Ruth coming to New York at this time, the start of the 20s, really saved the sport from the stink of corruption. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens now, because baseball, like every other major league sport, has invited the devil back into the room with gambling. They're so dependent on gambling. And the guy who they're desperately hoping is the next Babe Ruth, who they promote through, who Major League Baseball promotes through any without any restraint, Shohei Ohtani, may well be involved in this gambling scandal. And if he is, I hope not, but if he is, that's going to be a serious threat to the integrity of the game.
Well,
So we'll see how that works out.
the NBA just kicked out one of its players
Yeah.
for gambling.
I think the feeling is the money is so big now that nobody will be stupid enough to bet on game, to fix games. But gambling, like so many other things, is an addiction. It's something people get obsessed with, and they go too far and they can't back out of it. So I think Major League Sports is a big awakening coming.
It's funny you say that about the money's too big now. When I was in high school, I was doing a paper on the Black
Yeah.
Sox
Oh, yeah.
scandal, and I wrote to I forget who the PR guy at Major League Baseball was at the
Yeah.
time and asked him if that could happen again. He said, "No, the money's too big." And this is back in the
Yeah.
late 70s. So,
Yeah.
so.
Yeah, in those days, the well, there was it got to a thing where the money was so big that if you fix the game, the odds would change very conspicuously. But now that you can bet on anything, every play pretty much, it's I think it'll be much easier to hide some kind of fix. And that's and not everybody is making the money the players make.
Right,
You
right,
have umpires, you have clubhouse, you have all kinds of other people who probably look at that and envy that money. And it's not a good situation.
Well, we've been talking with Kevin Baker, author of The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. When is the next book coming out on this?
The sequel will be out in spring of 2026. 2 years from now. So and yeah, we'll go from 1945 to 2026. So hope people will look for, hope they like this. Hope they'll look for the next one.
Well, I certainly will. Kevin Baker, thank you so much for talking with us today. Good luck and have fun with the promotions of the book.
Thanks so much for having me, Ron.